from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we'll try and find out what's going on at DQ University near Davis. Also, we'll talk with science writer Timothy Ferris. He's in town with his film Seeing in the Dark, which tells stories about the important contributions made by amateurs to the field of astronomy. But first, as you just heard on NPR News, the Olympic torch is in San Francisco today, along with thousands of protesters. Four Sacramentans are among the several dozen people who are sharing the task of carrying the torch. Many others from our area and all over the place are also there to make their feelings known about the upcoming Olympics in China. We have a guest in our studio we're going to touch base with who has an interest in the Olympics in China, but we're going to start with a woman who's in San Francisco. Her name is Rachel Goldstein. She's a UC Davis student in San Francisco to protest the running of the Olympic torch. Rachel, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you tell us first where you are, and have you seen the torch?
Sure. I'm currently right in front of the ferry building on the Embarcadero, and the torch is actually rerouted because of the high volume of protesters. I would say that protesting is definitely higher than the supporting rate amongst the people here. So we were hearing rumors that the torch is actually put onto a ferry and left, but I just heard word that it was actually rerouted to Van Ness and Pine. So we're pretty far from the actual torch at this point, but the fact that they had to move it due to the high volume of protesters, in my opinion, is a good thing.
If it turns out that you never see the torch, will you be disappointed?
No, I won't, because I personally feel that if they have to move it, they know that the volume of protesting is to the point where, you know, none of us are actually boycotting the Olympics, but we do feel that China should utilize its, you know, economic and diplomatic leverage over countries that are, you know, harboring human rights abuses as well as their own human rights abuses in Tibet. So
there are various reasons why different people are protesting China, but your particular interest, as I understand, is Darfur. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. I work with STAND, which is a Student Anti-Genocide Coalition, and I've been involved with it since my junior year of high school, so about 4 years now. I'm the West Coast Advocacy Coordinator, so I helped with the student planning of this rally, and China has a really, really unique opportunity to influence the government of Sudan because they do arm transfers with Sudan, and all the arms that are being sold to Sudan are going straight to funding the Janjaweed, which is the militia that's carrying out the government-backed genocide in Darfur. So really, not only the arms transfers, but also China purchases over 60% of Sudan's oil. So, and all of the oil profits go straight to funding the military.
So what would you like China to do differently in Sudan?
I would like them to, have meetings with the government in Sudan, send another envoy. They sent an envoy after Steven Spielberg pulled out from the artistic director of the Olympics. But I think they need to be doing a lot more. I think it's a lot of talk and very little action. I think that if they were to utilize that leverage that they have, that huge economic leverage, if they were to even, you know, threaten Sudan by saying we're not going to buy your oil anymore, or we're not going to continue to, you know, send you arms, I think that would really pressure Sudan to stop their actions, because until Sudan really feels it in their pocketbooks and in their, really personally, they're not going to do anything to stop the genocide. So
I'm talking with Rachel Goldstein. She's a UC Davis student who's in San Francisco, standing outside the ferry building on the Embarcadero to protest the running of the Olympic torch. She's a West Coast Advocacy Coordinator for STAND, which is a student group opposed to the Sudan government's treatment of the people of Darfur. Why do you think the Chinese government would care what a student from UC Davis is saying and doing in San Francisco?
That's a good question. Something we've definitely toyed with a lot. I don't think they're going to care what I have to say, but I think they're going to care that the fact that there's thousands of protesters here, there are thousands of protesters in France, there are thousands of protesters at every torch relay that there is going to be. So I think it really is sending a message of world solidarity with Darfur and also with China's other human rights abuses in Tibet, and So I think China is really going to get the message. And, you know, again, we're trying to use the Olympics as a way to reach China, and we're not calling for a boycott of the Olympics in general. So
you're not calling for the U.S. or U.S. athletes to boycott the Olympics, but still, is there anything that you would like done or not done? Some people have called on President Bush to not go to the opening ceremonies.
Right, and I'm actually in favor of that because I feel like that's not actually a sporting event, so it would be sending a message to the government of China. I'm not for boycotting the actual Olympic Games because I think that, you know, they do stand for brotherhood and, you know, sisterhood and world peace. But I think that doing something like boycotting the opening ceremony really sends a strong message to China that we're not okay with its policies.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really just trying to use this as a way to reach China and not necessarily boycott the Olympics.
And finally, Rachel, roughly how many other people that you know came down from Davis and the Sacramento area?
Sure. Well, we had a bus of 30 students from UC Davis, but I know that there was also community members that came down from the Sacramento area.
Okay.
There's also people that came from all over the country, because this is the only torch stop in North America. So I have no idea how many people are here, but I can tell you that for blocks and blocks, all you can see is protesters. So,
Rachel Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
That's Rachel Goldstein, a UC Davis student. She's in San Francisco protesting the Olympic torch. As you might have heard, she has not seen the torch, and it has apparently been rerouted. We've heard from someone else we're in contact with in San Francisco that it was seen at Van Ness and Sutter, which was certainly not, as I understand, on the original route. We don't actually know what's going on, unfortunately, and that's just the nature of the situation in San Francisco. We're going to continue our discussion with another Sacramento area person who has an interest in the Olympics being held in China. He's Michael Halfhill, a member of the steering committee that's trying to bring the Dalai Lama to Sacramento. Michael Halfhill, welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
What do you think about China holding the Olympics?
I think it's a complicated issue. I don't think any of these kind of issues are very simple to work through and all. I think one of the things that China has to be aware of if they want to be on the world stage, that they're going to be examined in many different ways, and this is certainly one of the ways that it's playing out.
Your interest, I guess, is primarily how China is handling Tibet. Would that be fair to say?
My personal interest?
Yes,
personal
it
would interest. Be my personal interest, yes. Yeah.
Why do you think protesting around the Olympics could help Tibet?
I think it is an issue that has been brought onto the world stage. And like I said just a little bit earlier, that what China's going to have to realize is that the whole world is watching, and what part of the scrutiny is going to be is about what they're doing within China, which includes Tibet.
You went to the candlelight vigil last night in San Francisco.
That's correct, yeah.
Where there were some rather well-known people, the actor Richard Gere, who's a Tibetan Buddhist, an American, of course, and Desmond Tutu was speaking there.
Yeah.
How many people were at the event, and what did you hear that resonated with you?
Well, we weren't really sure how many people were there. It seemed like thousands did show up for it. There was numerous keynote speakers, and Richard Gere was the final speaker that came through. One of the things that he did emphasize, which a lot of them did, which is really the message that the Dalai Lama has carried for years and is unwavering about, that the answer to a lot of these problems is through nonviolence and through peace. So if people want to protest, to please feel free to use your right to protest, but to do it nonviolently.
What happens if there is violence in the protests, either in San Francisco or elsewhere?
I can give you my personal views about that.
Please.
I think unfortunately the world and the media does pick up on those kind of actions, and so the good news is that's where the attention is going to be had.
Mm.
So the Dalai Lama, I know, did put a letter out over the weekend encouraging all of the Tibetans to reexamine their roots and to remember where they came from and what their path is, and that path is of nonviolence.
What's your personal connection to Tibet, if you have one?
I don't have particularly a personal connection to Tibet. I am I'm a travel photographer and an audiovisual artist, and I visited Tibet a few years ago as a result of being a Dharma student and supporting the Dalai Lama and his works.
And tell us what you saw in Tibet that clearly had an impact on you.
one of the reasons that I did want to go was to see firsthand. You hear a lot of things about Tibet, as you do in many parts of the world, of what's going on. And I think as Westerners, we're extremely isolated from things that go on around the world. So one of the beautiful things that I get to do in my travels is to go there firsthand and see what I can see for myself. I did feel a lot of oppression. And one of the examples that I can give you is that back then when I went a few years ago, there were approximately 300 jobs that were given to the Tibetan people as tour guides. Before we went, the Chinese government eliminated 250 of those positions and gave it to the Chinese people. Mm-hmm. So there were essentially only 50 tour guides left, and we fought real hard to make sure that we got that we were able to have a Tibetan guide for various reasons, and we did get one. They harassed them the whole time. They actually took them away for hours at a time and even overnight a few times.
In your opinion, do you think it's appropriate for China to host the Olympics?
Tough questions.
Yeah.
It's a tough question. I think that they have a right to host it, but I also believe that they have to take what comes down to them from the world stage.
What do you think people and governments should do about the Olympics this summer? Well, let's start with the running of the torch, the relay. Do you think it's appropriate to protest these? And when it comes to the actual contests themselves, is it appropriate to boycott them, in your opinion? What about the opening ceremonies?
I'm not sure about boycotting them. I think there is a lot of concern that I've expressed in my world about why the International Olympic Committee gave the games to China anyway, knowing full well that they have a track record of some of the harms that they have done to other cultures. I'm not sure if they did that wisely or unwisely, but the good news out of the whole thing is that this is now being brought to the world stage, and it gives us a chance to explore it with a lot of unity behind it versus being very isolated and fragmented around the world. And I think every country has the right to speak up for themselves, how they want to handle this.
My guest is Michael Hafhill, a member of the steering committee that's trying to bring the Dalai Lama to Sacramento. Why did you go to the candlelight vigil last night in San Francisco, but not to the protests today?
Time-wise was the only reason why I didn't go today. I was actually trying to go. I understood that they were going to change the route today, and no one was really sure what was going to happen around the torch. So I came back last night. I went with a few friends. We wanted to go support the aspect of nonviolence and support the message that the Dalai Lama carries, which is the peace and nonviolence is really the way to go in these things. We have to find a way to work together.
I haven't seen any violence in TV clips that I've seen today from San Francisco, but it seemed that some of the most heated people that I saw appeared to be Tibetan activists. Did you experience any of that last night at the candlelight vigil that was about Tibet?
No, not at all. It was very well run last night. Everybody was very cordial, very polite. I didn't see anybody, burning cars or trashing anybody or anything along those lines. It was really nice to see it was very organized.
And given what you think about Tibet and China's involvement there, do you plan to watch the Olympics this summer?
I haven't even thought that far yet, quite honestly. I just never really thought about it because we're kind of in the middle of everything we're doing right now. Yeah. I am a sports advocate. Matter of fact, last night they actually brought up on stage two former Olympiads who are carrying there's a torch now that has been put together on the Tibetan peace torch. And they were the ones that were advocating carrying the peace torch around the country and possibly around the world. So from what I understand, a lot of the Olympiads are starting to stand up and decide for themselves how they want to respond to the world pressure on China.
Mm. Michael Hafhill is a Dharma student and a member of the steering committee bringing the Dalai Lama to Sacramento. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We also put out a call this morning to someone we know in Sacramento who has a strong interest in Chinese culture and history, but at this point we have not yet heard back from him. We also contacted someone from Sacramento who's one of the people carrying the torch in San Francisco. That person wanted to talk with us in Insight, but was unable because the torch carriers are required to stay with the Olympic torch relay caravan from 11 this morning to about 4 this afternoon, and were unable to carry personal items, including cell phones, which meant we were not able to talk with that person on the air. Our thanks also to Rachel Burns for valuable production assistance in San Francisco. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, what's going on at DQ University? We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A group of engineers from Sacramento are taking their expertise to Panama. On the next Insight, you'll meet some local members of Engineers Without Borders and hear their plans. Also, the lead climbing ranger at Mount Shasta tells you how to make it to the top and back down safely. Plus, learn how StoryCorps influenced the Sacramento woman to start her own personal recording business. That's Insight tomorrow. What's going on at DQ University? The school, founded in 1971 as California's first tribal college. As you might recall, DQ lost its accreditation 3 years ago and was then closed. But people identifying themselves as students are still on the campus, living there and organizing classes. Several have been arrested in recent days and months. A little later, we'll talk with a couple of key people involved in the struggle over DQ University. But we'll start with a newspaper reporter who's covering the story. He's Jake Dorsey of the Daily Democrat of Woodland. Jake Dorsey, welcome to Insight.
Hey there, Jeffrey. Good to be here.
What's the most recent news from DQ University?
The most recent news comes from Sunday. They held a ceremony out there, and we're supposed to hold a community meeting. That didn't quite happen, though. They didn't quite have enough people, but they got their goal accomplished. An associated student body, which they say is a established nonprofit now, they've elected leaders. They've elected people that they want to be nominees to go on the board of trustees for DQ.
And tell us about the arrests that have been happening in and around DQ in recent months.
The arrests pretty much all come from, it's a squabble kind of between the board president, Calvin Hedrick, and the other board of trustees. The board of trustees want to move forward. They want to have some chance, anyway, to get DQ off the ground. And they see the occupants out there at DQ as a roadblock. So on February 20th, and then again on March 31st, they had Yolo County Sheriff's deputies go out there and just arrest everybody they can. Just get them off the property, get them out of there. And they've tried that twice now. Right now, DQ is more or less empty, but not for lack of trying. It looks like some supporters tried to get into the dormitories again, but they couldn't drill all the way through the locks and get in. So right now it's empty, but, you know, they still go out there. They still think they can. They still believe they have a right to be on that land. And they say that there are court orders that say that they can, and there's just the general purpose of the land.
Jake Dorsey of the Daily Democrat, the Woodland newspaper, he's covered the DQ story. Jake, remind our listeners who don't know where DQ is. Where is DQ? How big is it?
DQ is 640 acres. It's off County Road 31 in Yolo County. It's pretty close to Davis. It's kind of on the outskirts. The land actually is not all, I should say, it's not all owned by the Board of Trustees. It's actually in trust with the federal government still. The Board of Trustees does run the land, though. Technically, the land is split kind of down the middle. Half of that land still belongs to the Department of Education. It's kind of their investment, if you will, in the land. And then the other half is completely free and clear DQs.
And why did the school lose its accreditation in 2005?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. The most major reason is they lost their funding. The Department of Education required, as part of the rules, that DQ had to maintain 51% or better Native American population for their enrollment. At some point in the early 2000s, DQ was still losing money. They were losing students. Some would say that that's because of corruption and embezzlement. Some say it was just financial mismanagement. But regardless, they went below 51%. So the Department of Education said, okay, sorry, you're losing your money. We're taking away your Pell Grants. All of that's gone. You're going to have to find a way to fund your own students. After that happened, most of the students were gone, and a few managed to hang on. But afterward, the accreditation agency for California just said, you know what, no, you're... Mm-hmm. you've got basically no students, you've lost most of your money, you're spending your endowment like nothing else, we're just going to take away your accreditation.
Okay. Jake Dorsey at the Daily Democrat. We'll turn now to someone who is heavily involved in the struggle over DQ University. He's Chris Yazzie. He joins us by phone. Chris, welcome to Insight.
Hey, welcome.
Chris, the DQ Board of Trustees says that the people on campus are trespassers, but you identify yourself as a student. Could you first explain to us what your status is?
Well, it's a student for the school and also a student of the land, caretaking the land. In the summer of 2007, the board recognized me as a caretaker in an oral statement during a board meeting. And in 2006, the Board of Trustees recognized our indigenous permaculture with an instructor as a class. And what's going on at DQ, you must have a prerequisite in the seventh generation knowledge. And we got young people with seventh generation thoughts and seventh generation energies recognizing the flaws and faults in our lifestyles and organization structures. And we're addressing what we see as important change for the most positive empowerment of the people. We got police repression, political ignorance, environmental destruction, homelessness, displacement occurring because of political and bureaucratic instability. What we have is a degenerate board structure. We have John Wayne sheriffs trying to bust Indian heads to this day. We got local land mongrel Dwayne Chamberlain destroying the land with use of herbicides and pesticides with an illegal lease with the Board of Trustees. We have genocide taking place in front of us. We have children fighting for their right of life.
Okay, Chris, there's a lot of noise behind you. Could you tell us where you are?
I'm at UC Davis.
Okay, how much time do you spend at DQ?
I spend all my time there. Most of my time.
Okay. And what would you like to have happen? What would you like to see change?
Yes, I'd like to see the Board of Trustees fulfill the board and start moving in a direction that is accountable and respectable. I want to see the communities and the board allow councils of youth, community, and elders to control the powers of DQ and share in the responsibilities of the important decisions that are to come. I want to also see the councils come from DQ also confront important questions in Indian country within our own community. I want to see the trespassing charges dropped and stopped, and the stop of the police involvement. And I want to see the Board of Trustees filled with motivated people ready to confront the task at hand. I want to have the associated student body classes recognized and implemented as legal DQU courses.
But Chris, if the Board of Trustees asked the Sheriff's Department to remove you and others from the campus, what right do you have to be there? You said that the Board of Trustees had recognized you, but it seems to me that the Board of Trustees does not recognize you.
Well, that's something we're going to be proving to them in court. And we do have a right to an education with the newly the document, the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and it's an international law, but the United States have yet to see this international law as something they want to recognize. And with this, with the Declaration of Indigenous Rights of Indigenous Peoples, we have a right to education by whatever means, and we have the state. The state is responsible to recognize our ways as viable. So therefore, we're working towards the future. We're working towards that seventh generation because we were living on the prayers of seven generations ago.
Okay. That's Chris Yazzie, who's one of the leaders of the people who identify themselves as students, although they're considered by others to be trespassers at DQ University. In our studio is Calvin Hedrick, Chairman of the Board of Trustees at DQ University. Calvin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How do you describe the people who are currently at or spending some of the time at DQ?
Well, I know that...
Are the students or not, basically?
That I have actually recognized Chris and some of the other people who have been out there for quite a while as students. You know, I have seen what they've done with their indigenous permaculture and the garden. But I know that there are a lot of people out there who I don't know. In my opinion, I think that if someone wants to call themselves a student, they can call themselves a student. Unfortunately, we don't have accreditation right now. So that, I mean, it's sort of up in the air about what that means.
Do you think Chris and the others have the right to be on the campus?
I definitely think that it's bothered me that Indian people have been arrested at DQ. It really has. As a board of trustee member, I know that, you know, as a board member, I had tried to, speak with the sheriff so that anybody breaking the law out there, anything, you know, that was going wrong, that those people would be arrested because the sheriff's department didn't recognize anybody as in control out there. And we had those meetings with the sheriff so that, you know, we could tell them, listen, the board are the people in control. A few of the board members had sort of taken it upon themselves to go out there and, you know, use the sheriff's to kind of sweep the place clean rather than just focus on the people who might have been, you know, a problem out there, just sweep the place clean of all the people staying out there.
I was faxed a copy of a letter with DQ University letterhead, which was signed by you on behalf of the board, mm-hmm. which says, you know, basically requesting help from the Yolo County Sheriff's Department with, quote, current problems concerning the removal of trespassers on the campus. Said that in future, anyone who's granted permission to live on campus must have a letter of authorization. Did you have a different opinion then about who these people were and why they were there and whether they should be there?
I definitely had a different opinion. I mean, because there was an individual who had been removed from the campus and he came back. He had been asked to leave and he came back. There have been several people who were out there basically for the wrong reason without DQ's best interest, and I think that there's a lot of confusion about you know what who can be out there and who shouldn't be out there. We definitely, you know, in 2007, as Chris said, we recognized him as a caretaker, and you know that has come into question a couple of times. By the Board of Trustees.
Is there a split between you and the other members of the Board of Trustees?
On this issue, there definitely is a split because I've stated more than once that I don't want to see any Indian people arrested out of DQ. I think that there are ways that we can handle this situation, you know, as people, as Indian people, and sit down and try to come to, you know, some sort of an agreement, you know, on this issue without involving, you know, the Sheriff's Department and negative publicity from the media.
We're talking about DQ University. My studio guest is Calvin Hedrick of the Board of Trustees at DQ University. A little time before the program started, I got a call from a woman who identified herself as Susan Reese and said she's a board spokesperson. And she said that you do not have permission to speak for the board. What response do you have to that statement?
I am speaking for myself. I am the chairman of the board, and I am speaking for myself. I don't necessarily have, you know, I'm not speaking for the entire board. I know that Susan Reese herself proclaimed, you know, spokesperson for the board. You know, I'm
consultant
not
was the word she used with me, right. But I've been told she subsequently used the word spokesperson.
Yeah, she uses a lot of different words. She was a former board member who had come on and sort of been like a historian and kind of helped us out and has now given herself new titles.
And I hate to get bogged down in inside baseball, but I was also she sent me some bylaws of the Board of Trustees, which says elections of regular trustees shall take place in April of each year. And she implied by that therefore, you know, you need to be reelected to be on the board. Has there been an election, a reelection of the Board of Trustees this month? One planned?
I believe the elections are for the Executive Council. That's the chair, the vice chair, the secretary, and the treasurer.
Okay.
I was put on the board. I was in June of 2005. The term is a 3-year term. So in June of this year, my term will be up. And then, you know, whether or not I want to continue as a board member, you know, I'll make that decision at that time. And basically, I'll just have to reapply.
When I was talking with Jake Dorsey at the Daily Democrat, we did touch on the complicated issue of who owns the land and the property. What's your take on that? Who owns DQ University?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, and this is going to be very broad, but I think the people own DQ University. I think that, you know, that my job as...
There's no legal status there. I mean, who can enforce anything or tell anyone what to do if it's owned by everyone?
Well, I think that the board oversees, you know, DQ University, and I think that that's our responsibility. I think that Jake was one half of the land is held in trust by the General Services Administration, and the other half is with the Department of Education. So
That's complicated.
It's very complicated. And to be honest with you, when I got on the board, trying to figure out exactly where we stood was a difficult place. And, you know, I've done a lot of research to try to figure out exactly what our responsibility is. And basically, you know, we're responsible for what happens out there. We're responsible for making sure that it's an educational institution. And so that's the responsibility of the board. But we work for the people.
Let's touch base with our other two guests again. Jake Dorsey at the Daily Democrat. You've been listening to my conversation with Chris Yazzie and Calvin Hedrick. What would you like to add?
Well, I think it really shows that there's not just two sides to this story. There's actually really quite a few. I'd say like more than five at this point. You really see that on the side of the kind of occupants or students, whatever they call themselves, there's a lot of passion there. There's a lot of emotion behind that. Whereas the Board of Trustees is really trying to treat it like a business, a corporation, you know, something that's legitimate. You know, when it comes to funding for the future of DQ, what future is there? Right now, according to every source I've talked to, there's not much of one. There are credits in the tank. They owe at least $150,000 to the Department of Education. They've got no reputation right now. So there's that passion that's on the side of the students. You almost want to really use some of that. It's very important. There's something there that needs to be used, but the sides are just so divided. They're very much apart from each other right now.
Chris Yazzie, I'll just pose that question to you. How do you turn passion into money and reputation and a solid place in the community?
I think the support of, we need to support the students' movement at DQU, allow them to help themselves and help the seventh generation ahead of us with the thoughts and energies to change the world for them and the ways of which we balance ourselves in the teachings of knowledge of the old with the ancestors' knowledge, but also keeping a foot working forward, moving forward for our seventh generation descendants, and to recognize the youth movement as a growing urgency to stand as human beings and not stand behind leaders or borders or structures of boards.
Okay. And finally, Calvin Hedrick, what's your take on the way forward for DQ?
I've been thinking about that a lot over the last couple of months and, you know, what my place is there. I'm not ready to give up at DQ. I know that a lot of people have come to me and said, you know, it's time to give up. It's dead. I don't believe that, you know, as I was saying before I came in that, you know, I made a promise to my grandparents before they passed away that I would do things for Indian people, that I would use my education for Indian people. And I just don't feel like, you know, if we gave up now, that we would be fulfilling those promises, because I know a lot of people have made those promises. And you know, my way forward is to, you know, try to deal with the board as it sits right now, try to deal with a lot of people who have said that they would like to be board members now. You know, prior to these arrests, I had been working on trying to develop relationships again with different community agencies, different tribal communities. And, you know, just to try to continue that, try to pick up where that stopped, because, you know, for the last couple of months, we've been working just on this issue. And continue to try to get accreditation back, continue to try to get classes going out there, even if they're cultural classes that don't have that we don't need accreditation for, that just are teaching people something. We need to continue to do that out there and just move forward.
Also, Calvin, a listener called us to ask what DQ stands for. I know that it's a sensitive issue because for some people those words are too sacred to be said, but how would you answer that question?
That's right. The first word is I believe he's a prophet from an East Coast tribe, and his name is not supposed to be spoken, and so I won't speak it. The second one is Quetzalcoatl, which is a Chicano deity, I believe, and basically it represents, you know, the North and the South indigenous peoples, the people who actually, you know, jumped the fence to take DQ for a tribal college.
Thank you all very much. On the phone, Chris Yazzie and Jake Dorsey. Jake Dorsey is a reporter for the Daily Democrat newspaper, and Chris Yazzie is a leader of the people who are organizing classes at DQ University, and Calvin Hedrick, who's chairman of the Board of Trustees at DQ University in our studio. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, my talk to us there.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, science writer Timothy Ferris. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight details at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, a new report says Stanislaus County's infant mortality rate is higher than both the statewide rate and the national rate. That story later today on All Things Considered. Some of the most notable astronomers around today are amateurs, and their story was told recently in the PBS film Seeing in the Dark. The person who made the film and wrote the book of the same name is science writer Timothy Ferris. He lives in the Bay Area, but he's in town to present his film and talk about it tonight at UC Davis. We'll talk with him in a moment, but first here's a clip from Seeing in the Dark.
Looking through a telescope, it opens up an entire new world. I mean, there's always this wow factor, you know, this, I can't believe that I'm actually seeing this.
Timothy Ferris, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be here.
How can amateurs really make a contribution to a field so expensive and so as expensive to practice as astronomy?
Well, really, for two reasons. One is that the sky is there, unlike studying the depths of the sea or remote archaeological sites. From anywhere with a halfway dark sky, you can see a lot of stars. And the other reason is technological. Inexpensive telescopes, inexpensive light-sensitive chips of the kind that we see in all these consumer cameras now, and the Internet have conspired to make it possible to really make discoveries with small equipment. And actually, in our Seeing in the Dark Internet telescope, which is available for free to students and teachers over the Internet, which is just a small commercial instrument, you can carry the telescope in your arms, discovered what's called a gamma ray burst, an explosion more than 8 billion light years away just a couple of weeks ago. So that's light that's older than the Earth, coming from more than halfway across the universe.
My goodness.
Imaged with just one of these little amateur setups.
So has technology made it easier to be a significant amateur astronomer than it used to be?
Well, certainly less expensive. There is still a lot of sweat equity that goes into learning how to get the most out of a telescope. But particularly in the area of discoveries, you don't have to know a lot of astrophysics to take an image of an exploding star or comet. And there are a lot of amateur astronomers out there now who have the capability to do this. And so as the Earth has been developing, you know, all these eyes and other sensory organs over the decades, and now to the professional instruments have been added tens of thousands of these amateur telescopes, some of them making real discoveries.
So the march of civilization has helped at least make astronomy cheaper to practice. But the march of civilization has also brought a lot of pollution, light pollution, ozone pollution, and so on, which I guess makes it harder for someone whose job is not astronomy and therefore doesn't just make off to South America for 3 months at a time, makes it harder to actually practice meaningful astronomy.
Well, it's harder to see things in a light-polluted sky. Actually, you can sometimes image pretty well. There's an amateur astronomer in downtown London, right in the middle of London, who does spectroscopy of stars, and he's actually published some important data. I do have hope that we can reverse the trend toward ever greater light pollution, because really no one benefits from it. It's an issue that I find that once people learn a little about it, they see the advantages of keeping those lights pointing downward and saving some energy in the process and preserving the dark night sky.
My guest is Timothy Ferris, the science writer. He's showing his film Seeing in the Dark and speaking about it tonight at UC Davis. The film first aired on PBS in the fall of 2007. You are yourself an amateur astronomer.
I have been since 1956. when I got a little telescope to see the opposition of Mars, a time when Mars comes close to the Earth.
Yes. Do you hang out with other amateur astronomers? Is that what led you to the book and then the film?
Well, to some degree, but it's always when I started out, there weren't any amateur astronomers around. This was in rural Florida, and so I educated myself through reading books in the local public library, and I've ever since viewed public libraries as miraculous institutions.
Did you ever wonder how things would have been different for you if you had become a professional astronomer? Did you ever think that was something you'd like to do?
I never did. My parents were both writers, and I seemed to be kind of a hardwired writer, and I always thought of myself in literary terms. So as much as I like science, I would be a first-rate scientist, but it is a great subject to write about.
What do you enjoy most about astronomy?
Well, of course, you have the aesthetic beauty of it, and one of the wonderful things in the film Seeing in the Dark is that with today's technology, and particularly with high-definition television technology, it's possible to begin to show a television audience what it really looks like out there. The views that we've had through television previously have been very constrained, and it's astonishing what these gigantic structures begin to look like when you bring technology to bear on them.
One of the things about astronomy that affects a lot of people is the scale of the universe. And I guess the more you look through a telescope and study images, the more you're confronted with the unimaginable vastness of the universe. And some people get freaked out by that. How do you deal with the unimaginable vastness of this thing you're looking at?
It is unimaginable. Whenever you try to understand the cosmic scheme of things, the scale of it, you always come up against the fact that there's one step on the staircase that's just too high to step over. For me, it's the step up to the size of our galaxy. Galaxies are really big. The distance between galaxies is only a few galaxy diameters, so the universe on that scale doesn't look so absurdly large, although there are more than 100 billion galaxies in it. But they are unimaginable, and I suppose for that reason that I don't see why they should trouble us particularly. I mean, the alternative would be, I suppose, that the universe would be small. Suppose the universe consisted of, a dozen stars. It'd be a much less interesting and challenging subject. As it is, the potential for discovery is limitless. We're never, as a species, going to run out of things to learn.
Timothy Ferris is showing and speaking about his film Seeing in the Dark about amateur astronomers tonight at UC Davis. There's some interesting people that are featured in the film. Tell us about your favorite amateur astronomer that you came across in making the film.
We came across some really fascinating people. Some of them, like Barbara Wilson, who's a Houston housewife who was fascinated by astronomy as a girl, then discouraged from studying science in schools, as many girls and women have been. And then, as a married woman, rediscovered it and turned out to be one of the great observers in the world. Barbara has seen things that no one else had ever been able to see before. Other people in the film were folks that we hadn't encountered until we started working on the film, like Robert Smith, who's the football fans will remember as the most effective running back in the history of the Minnesota Vikings. Robert is an avid amateur astronomer and shows school kids, including the high school football players that he now coaches as a part-time job, the views of the universe that in the film we see him showing these kids a galaxy 2 million light years away from the center of downtown Miami. So even with light pollution, you can still see some things.
What are the pros the professional astronomers make of these former housewives, former NFL running backs, all these kinds of people who are amateur astronomers? Do they indulge them? Do they welcome them? Do they run away from them?
I think the attitude now is welcoming. Astronomy used to be a small and rather vertical profession that did have a kind of standoffish attitude to the amateurs. The internet has done a lot to help with that. It has democratized the exchange of information. There are huge masses of data on the internet in which one can simply make astronomical discoveries if you're prepared to do the work. And I think there's been a growing recognition on the part of professional astronomers that there are a lot of jobs that the professional telescopes can't do. For instance, as we see in the film, there's an amateur astronomer in Pleasanton, California, who saw the slight difference in the light from a star, indicating that a planet was transiting, was crossing between us and that star. An astonishing observation, but it's hard to get time on a big professional telescope to wait for something like that to happen.
You were, I read, a finalist in the NASA Journalist in Space program, but that was suspended after the Challenger disaster.
Yes.
That would have involved you becoming an astronaut, I guess.
Yeah, as well as kind of a short-term
astronaut.
Amateur astronaut.
And did you ever manage to go to space?
I haven't, no.
Still waiting for the call.
Yes, I'm still waiting for the call. It's getting, I don't know how many 63-year-old amateur astronauts they're looking for now, but...
Would you still like to go if you had the chance?
Oh, sure, wouldn't you?
I mean, you bet.
Not
much call for interviewers in space either, unfortunately.
No, the course of space exploration has not been all that some of us had hoped for. But on the other hand, there have been humans in space uninterruptedly every single day since the year 2000. So there is some progress being made.
But you do have some kind of presence in space that's going ever further away. That's you produced the phonograph record on Voyager.
Yes.
How did you get that job?
Well, I had Carl Sagan was a good friend. He used to stay at my place in New York when he was in New York. And one night he was there, and he said that it appeared that NASA might actually give the okay to expand what had been these little plaques that had gone on two previous spacecraft into a somewhat larger plaque that they realized could be a phonograph record. You could etch analog music and sounds into the record. The twin Voyagers are interstellar spacecraft. They're now leaving the solar system. And so we made, in rather short time, just a matter of about 4 or 5 months, these records as a, it's one record at half speed, so it's 2 hours long, of music and natural sounds and even some images from the Earth. I recently ran a program where you can go out to where Voyager is and look back.
Yeah.
And the sun is just one more star now from there. It's the brightest star in the sky, but it's just one more star, and you can't see the planets at all.
Do you think anyone will ever hear that record?
I have no idea. We just don't know. We don't know anything about the prevalence of extraterrestrial life or intelligent life. But aside from that, it did function, I think, as a mirror held up to ourselves, and I think it was one small step in this process of going from a primitive notion that there's just one world and just one intelligent species to realizing that there are trillions of worlds and that we really have no idea what, if anything, is living on them.
And we're just about out of time, but I must ask you this. What's the most memorable sound on that record on Voyager, in your opinion? What's the one you hope the extraterrestrials hear?
I'm quite fond of the music. There's Chuck Berry. There's a piece called Dark Was the Night, which features in the theme music of the film. Mark Knopfler and Guy Fletcher did the music, and the theme is based on this old blues written by a homeless man. So I'm quite fond of the music. I mixed this sound Portrait of the Earth, which has everything from a baby and a kiss to the sounds of volcanoes and earthquakes and technology, and it's hard to pick out any particular thing, but that stands out in memory. But the sense of doing a sound portrait of a planet and of a species was one that was exciting to us and challenging then, and remains so today.
I can imagine. Thank you so much. Timothy Ferris, science writer. He's showing and talking about his film Seeing in the Dark, about amateur astronomers, tonight at UC Davis at 7:30 at the Arc Ballroom. Timothy Ferris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Andrew Frischman. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our interim producer is Robin Souza. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. A group of engineers from Sacramento are taking their expertise to Panama. On the next Insight, you'll meet some local members of Engineers Without Borders and hear their plans. Also, the lead climbing ranger at Mount Shasta tells you how to make it to the top and back down safely. Plus, learn how StoryCorps influenced the Sacramento woman to start her own personal recording business. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.